The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grasso from Bloomberg Radio.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grasso. The House impeaches Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on its second try. What will the Senate do? And the country's oldest judge loses her fight to be reinstated.
On this vote, the yeas are 214 and the nays are 213. The resolution is adopted.
House Republicans finally got that one-vote margin necessary to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in a redo of their failed attempt last week. Mayorkas, the first Latino and immigrant to head the department, is only the second cabinet member in U.S. history and the first in almost 150 years to be impeached. The impeachment articles charge Mayorkas with failing to enforce U.S. immigration law.
The allegations are baseless, and I'm focused on the work.
There's virtually no chance the Senate will have the necessary two-thirds majority to convict Mayorkas and remove him from office. Despite that, the House went forward with impeachment, succeeding with the vote of Republican Majority Leader Steve Scalise, who returned to Washington after being away for cancer treatments.
And if they ignore this, then there will be accountability and consequences to that action. So it's on the Senate.
Several leading conservative scholars, along with former Homeland Security secretaries from both Republican and Democratic administrations, have dismissed the Mayorkas impeachment as unwarranted or a waste of time, as has House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries.
This is extraordinary. This is the height of cynicism. Once again, they are embracing chaos and walking away from common sense.
Joining me is an expert in impeachment, Frank Bowman, a professor at the University of Missouri Law School, who testified before the Homeland Security Committee in January. They voted to impeach him on counts of willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law and breach of public trust, relating to his handling of immigration and security at the border. Even if proved, does that rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, with respect to the first claim that he actually willfully violated the law on a matter that was, you know, of real seriousness, I mean, I suppose if it were true, we could have a conversation. But it's not true. It's not even close to true. The best they can say is that he used the discretion conferred on him by law to interpret and apply a series of immigration laws which are both contradictory and confusing. And he did that in conformity with the directives of the president. There simply is no indication at all that he's violating the law. I mean, the primary thing that they claim he's violating the law on is the claim that the law requires that people who are in the country illegally must be detained and that they cannot be paroled. Well, it's just not true. I mean, the law itself has plenty of parole provisions. And in fact, on that particular point, the United States Supreme Court has actually held in one of the series of lawsuits brought against the Department and Secretary Mayorkas by some state Republican attorneys general, the Supreme Court's actually held that detention is not mandatory. So the thing that they are claiming he's violating the law on, the Supreme Court has basically said, no, that's not true. It's really quite remarkable. So we don't even need to get to the question of whether or not, in some hypothetical case, a sufficiently serious and plain violation of law would in itself be impeachable. The answer, I suppose, in theory, in the right case, might be yes, but he hasn't violated the law. What they've got is a series of lawsuits against him in which, you know, in the lower courts, they've won some and they've lost some. And in the only two that made it up to the Supreme Court, Republicans have lost. They don't have a final judgment against him suggesting that he's violated the law. It's all made up.
What about this breach of public trust? That's pretty broad.
Well, that is, in a piece I wrote on my blog, I refer to that count as a rag picker's bazaar because it's just got a bunch of stuff in it. For example, they claim he made false statements to the committee. No, he didn't. The claimed false statements that they are alleging he made are cases in which they're basically disagreeing with his use of adjectives and adverbs. In other words, they claim that he falsely claimed that apprehended aliens with no legal basis to remain in the United States were being quickly removed. The only thing to disagree with that is the word quickly. They're impeaching him because they don't like his use of the adjective quickly to modify removed. In other cases, he described the border as being secure or no less secure than it was previously. They claim that's a false statement. At most, it's an opinion about the efficiency of his administration and his agency. And we know, first of all, from the very time of the framing, that matters of opinion are not matters appropriate for impeachment. But in any case, if it were an impeachable offense for someone to go into Congress and provide a generous and even optimistic assessment of the performance of their own agency, or for example, a congressman to provide a generous spin on some matter of public policy, everybody would be impeachable. There is not a single instance of an actual false statement that they allege in this article. So that's one thing they claim. In that second article, they claim that there was an obstruction of congressional oversight. Well, for Republicans who defended Donald Trump, to claim that anybody else should be impeachable for obstruction of congressional oversight would make a dog laugh. And it's simply not true that Mayorkas obstructed congressional oversight. He, you know, has testified something like 27 times before various congressional committees, multiple times before this committee. He made like 90 witnesses available to Congress and to question about the operations of the department, provided tens of thousands of pages of documents. And, you know, at the very end, when the committee wanted to examine him, have him testify one more time, he responded by saying, well, on the particular day you've asked me to come, I'm actually meeting with Mexican officials to talk about border issues. Can we reschedule it? And they refused and went ahead and impeached him for obstruction. I mean, it's a joke. There's absolutely nothing in either of these articles. And I think that fact that that is so is indicated by the fact that they could not find a single legal expert of any kind, not a legal historian, you know, not a constitutional scholar, not a judge, not a lawyer, not a single person could they find to come down to Congress and say, yes, as a constitutional matter, what you're alleging is impeachable, because it's not there.
Also, just hours before the vote, the U.S. Border Patrol released new data showing that the number of migrants illegally crossing the southern border with Mexico plummeted by 50% in January compared with December. Who knows why, but does that mitigate against then impeaching him?
Well, performance numbers shouldn't be a matter of impeachability, right? I mean, that's the key here. Impeachment is a constitutional mechanism that is reserved for the most serious kinds of offenses. That's why you can only be impeached for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. It is a grave constitutional tool for the most serious of matters. It is not something that you trot out simply because you disagree with administration policy or you find the performance of a particular cabinet officer to be below your standards. I mean, there's a reason that Mayorkas is only the second cabinet officer ever to be impeached. It's because for 235 years, everybody understood that's the case, that you don't impeach people for policy differences. If you did, why you'd be impeaching people left, right, and sideways? The only cabinet officer who's ever been impeached was a guy who flagrantly committed bribery. The Republicans are stepping into dangerous new ground here where they're simply saying, well, anytime we don't like something the administration is doing, we can simply impeach the person who happens to be the head of the department who's doing most of it. So I don't think that it matters at all what the particular numbers are for impeachment purposes. However, that does, you know, take us into the larger picture here, which is even if your theory is I can impeach an officer because I'm really, really upset about the conduct of a particular policy area by the administration, the real thing you should be doing actually is you should be passing legislation to address the problem that you're so upset about. But of course, as we know, within the last, you know, 10 days or so, you know, a bipartisan group of senators negotiated a real piece of legislation that would have made very significant changes to immigration enforcement in this country. And then the very same people who want to impeach Mayorkas basically squashed it at the behest of Donald Trump because they don't want to solve the problem. They want to run on it. And that's all this is.
The House has appointed 11 Republicans to serve as impeachment managers. So then this goes over to the Senate. Does the Senate have to hold a trial?
an interesting question constitutionally. It's one we talked about in the first Trump case. I don't know the answer. Nobody really knows the answer. But certainly it appears that the Senate has concluded, that the majority leader has concluded, that something has to happen, that the Senate has to address it, because I gather they're going to commence something on like the 26th.
Well, he said that the appointed House Republican impeachment managers will present the articles to the Senate when senators return to Washington at the end of the month. And then the Senate President pro tem, Patty Murray, will preside over a trial. But I'm wondering if there's any way around that.
There is a mechanism by which one could avoid holding the full trial. Commonly, for the last several decades, at least, for lesser officers, people other than presidents, they've created a trial committee that will simply hold hearings, present a report to the full Senate, and the full Senate votes. I don't even think that will happen here. My best guess is that some sort of trial will be convened and that the presiding officer will probably entertain a motion to dismiss the case up front without the presentation of evidence, and that the vote will be taken, and my guess the whole thing will be dismissed without any evidence being presented. I don't know that. I have no inside information on that point. But something like that, you may remember, actually was attempted in certainly, I think, the second Trump case, where there's a motion to dismiss based on alleged lack of jurisdiction, and that motion failed, and they went forward with something in the nature of trial. I think in this case, the motion will pass very probably, and that will be the end of it.
Now, Mayorkas is not the only Biden administration official that House Republicans want to impeach. They're, of course, looking into impeaching President Biden. They filed legislation to impeach a list including Vice President Kamala Harris, Attorney General Merrick Garland, FBI Director Christopher Wray, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. What is wrong with this picture?
Well, I mean, one has to avoid overreacting a little bit in the sense that individual outlying members of the House of both parties have over time sometimes introduced resolutions to try to impeach this person or that person because they were ticked off. What's different here, obviously, is that what we have here is not simply the actions of one or two eccentrics. What we have here is a concerted effort by House Republicans to impeach people from the president on down without any grounds. And that is very, very bad. I mean, first, it terribly devalues the institution of impeachment itself, which is supposed to be reserved for the most serious instances of very grave official misconduct. If you are taking seriously completely non-serious allegations on a regular basis, then when something really serious comes along, it's too easy to dismiss it. So that's problem number one. And the other problem, of course, is that they're very likely to lead us down a path of sort of endless retaliatory impeachment or impeachment investigations. I mean, at this point, the phenomenon is limited to Republicans. But, you know, Democrats are not saints and should control the House shift, and Democrats be faced with a Republican president, I think there's at least going to be a temptation for them to start doing the same sort of performative foolishness. And that not only devalues impeachment, but it devalues the seriousness of the entire institution. It makes the House look silly. It wastes their time. It means that people looking on from afar are likely to think that anytime anybody raises impeachment, this isn't serious. This is just people being fools. And that's terrible. It's terribly dangerous. It removes one of the important constitutional protections against really serious misconduct. And it just wastes the country's time. It wastes the House's time. Republicans are doing something remarkably dangerous and remarkably foolish.
Well, we'll see what happens in this case on February 26th. Thanks so much, Frank. That's Professor Frank Bowman of the University of Missouri Law School. Coming up next, a 96-year-old judge loses her fight to be reinstated. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
96-year-old judge Pauline Newman, known for her dissents and expertise in patent law, has sat on the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals for almost 40 years. But for the last year, she's been fighting her suspension from the bench for refusing to undergo medical testing as part of an investigation into her fitness.
I think the nation needs my voice. I think that if the judges on this court are willing and more than willing to push me out in order to get me out of the way so that no one says that they've made a mistake, that I need to be here to countermand that.
Her prospects for reinstatement appear dim after most of her lawsuit challenging her suspension was dismissed on Monday by a D.C. federal judge, and the U.S. Judicial Conference's Committee on Conduct and Disability upheld the suspension last week. Joining me is Arthur Hellman, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School, who helped draft the laws courts use to police judges. Arthur, this case has gone off in so many different directions, so perhaps we should start at the beginning. Her fellow jurists on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit voted unanimously in September to bar her from getting new case assignments for at least a year or until she sat for court-ordered medical examinations. How did we get to that point?
Well, it's been a rather twisted path, and as you point out, it started back in February or March of last year. So we're now, 1 year into this very lengthy proceeding. But the chief judge of the circuit, Chief Judge Kimberly Moore, received reports from primarily staff, employees of the Federal Circuit, that Judge Newman seemed to be having cognitive or behavioral problems. And that led Chief Judge Moore initially to deny Judge Newman the opportunity to sit on the monthly panels for April and May of last year. And Judge Moore also identified a complaint against Judge Newman under the Judicial Conduct and Disability Act of 1980 that started an investigation which was carried out by a special committee of the Federal Circuit judges, three judges, including Judge Moore, that was to investigate the complaints primarily of disability. But that included a request, or really an order, to Judge Newman to undergo some neurological testing, submit some medical reports. Judge Newman refused to do any of those things, and that led Chief Judge Moore to add a complaint of judicial misconduct against Judge Newman. And that is what we're dealing with now. The underlying concern is about disability, but for almost the last year, the entire focus has been on misconduct, specifically failure to cooperate with the special committee.
And it's very unusual for the public to have a window into these kinds of proceedings, and it seemed to get very personal very fast.
Well, it's not only unusual, it's unprecedented. Nothing like this has ever happened. I mean, ordinarily, all of this would be going on in private, and in almost all other cases, it would have been resolved privately, and all we would have known was the ultimate resolution. And yes, I'm speaking as an outsider. I have no personal knowledge of any of the individuals involved. But my sense, from talking to people and from reading some of the blog commentaries, is that it does appear to be somewhat personal, which makes it especially regrettable that Chief Judge Moore did not take the opportunity to request Chief Justice Roberts to transfer this proceeding to another circuit. He could have done that under the rules, and I think if she had done that, we would be looking at a very different sort of proceeding at this point, with perhaps a happier outcome.
A 7-judge panel of the Judicial Conference of the United States Committee on Judicial Conduct and Disability, which I hadn't heard of until this case, said in a written decision that Newman didn't have good cause to refuse to cooperate with the appeals court investigation. Tell us about the decision.
Yes, as you've mentioned, this is a committee, a standing committee of the Judicial Conference of the United States, and that's a little known body, but it's a very important one because it's the administrative policymaking body of the national federal judiciary. And the statute that established the judicial conduct and disability proceeding authorizes the judicial conference to delegate its responsibilities under the act to a standing committee, which it has done. So this standing committee reviewed the order of the circuit council suspending Judge Newman and went through each of Judge Newman's objections to the proceeding, rejected each of them, and affirmed the order. I think it's pretty important to emphasize that throughout, the Judicial Conference Committee adopted a standard of deferential review that basically the committee decided that it would reverse or reject the council's conclusions only if the council abused its discretion. And that's a hard standard to meet, and in my view, one that was not entirely appropriate here, where you have a body of judges suspending an Article III judge from hearing cases for a substantial period of time.
And this is unusual, right? It was just the third written decision issued by the panel in more than 3 years.
Yes, the panel does not issue very many decisions. That assumes, of course, that all of their decisions are public. It may be that they do some work behind the scenes. For example, there's a reference in the opinion just issued to the fact that Judge Newman's counsel asked for interlocutory or immediate review of some of the judicial council orders. The conduct committee, the judicial conference committee, rejected that request, but there is no published order separately reflecting that. So there may be some other things that the committee has done behind the scenes, but you're right. The formal orders are very rare. It's unusual to have more than one or two a year.
As far as this, because there are a lot of moving pieces here, as far as the judicial conference's decision, is there an appeal from that possible?
That's a very interesting question, because under the rules that were adopted by the judicial conference to govern these proceedings, the full judicial conference does have the power to review a decision by the standing committee. There is no right to review by Judge Newman or anyone else, but the full conference does have the authority to do so. And I think it would be appropriate to do so here. There was actually a very interesting and little noticed proceeding just last year in another case proceeding under the Act, where the Judicial Council had affirmed a decision by a chief judge which dismissed a complaint. This was a complaint involving an assertion that two judges had hired a law clerk who engaged in some allegedly racist behavior. And the council, it was a case that had been transferred to another circuit. The council dismissed that complaint. The complainant appealed to the Judicial Conference Standing Committee. The Standing Committee directed the Judicial Council to reopen the investigation. And the two judges then argued that that order, the order requiring reopening, is contrary to the statute. And the Judicial Council, the Second Circuit, the Judicial Council asked the full judicial conference to give an opinion on that question. And to my great surprise, the judicial conference said that the rule authorizing that reopening, which had been promulgated by the judicial conference, was contrary to statute, which indeed it is. And I will just say that I made that argument many years ago when the rule was first adopted. So we have a very recent episode in which the full judicial conference has, in effect, overruled the standing committee. So that could happen here also. I don't expect it, but it could happen, and they have the power to do that.
Let me just get one thing straight. If she agrees to go for medical examinations, can she lift her suspension?
It's possible, but it is all in the hands of the Judicial Council. I think the Judicial Council orders are very clear that they will not allow her to hear cases again unless she complies with the special committee's various orders. But as I read their orders, they are not guaranteeing that if she does, they will let her rehear cases. And I think she is now, 96 years old? So time is against her ever hearing cases again, I have to say.
So this is proceeding on one track. Then she sued the Judicial Council, which includes the Chief Judge Kimberly Moore and the Federal Circuit's other active judges in the D.C. Federal District Court. And on Monday, the district court judge dismissed most of her suit.
Yes, allowed a little bit of it to go forward, although as I read the order, it's allowing it to go forward, but not really leaving much of a chance for Judge Newman. It's allowing it to go forward on what is called facial challenges to the act. In other words, arguments that the act itself is unconstitutional on its face in authorizing some of the things it did. Well, a facial challenge to an act of Congress is a very, very hard challenge to succeed in, which is why I say that I don't think it leaves much room for Judge Newman to prevail. The government will now make a motion to get rid of the rest of the case, and I suspect that the district court will do that. It's a very thorough and careful opinion, but I don't think it holds out much hope for Judge Newman.
Coming up next, I'll continue this conversation with Professor Arthur Hellman, and we'll talk about whether the federal judiciary is facing the problem of aging judges. A law review article in 2020 found that 75% of federal judges die while still serving on the bench. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by listening to our Bloomberg Law podcast. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
96-year-old Judge Pauline Newman has sat on the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals for almost 40 years and refused to retire or even take senior status.
I thought, what will I do now? I don't want to be a litigator. I don't want to be a mediator. I'd rather decide rather than mediate, as many judges do. If I had a family by that time, I would have had, who knows, great-grandchildren, I suppose. But I didn't take that path. I don't know why, but I didn't.
But she was suspended from the bench for refusing to undergo medical testing as part of an investigation into her fitness. And she's been fighting that suspension for the last year. Her prospects for reinstatement appear dim after most of her lawsuit challenging her suspension was dismissed on Monday by a D.C. District Court judge. I've been talking to ethics expert Arthur Hellman, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. Federal Judge Christopher Cooper said in the decision that earlier cases have, quote, consistently affirmed the judiciary's authority to police itself. Arthur, explain how that fits in with Judge Newman's claims in the lawsuit.
It's underlying the basic argument here that Judge Newman is making. High level is that under the Constitution, an Article III judge, such as Judge Newman, can be removed from office only by the process of impeachment in the House and then a trial in the Senate. And this suspension for 1 year, which could be longer, is the functional equivalent of removing her from office, and as such is not authorized by the Constitution. But the council argues, and the D.C. Circuit has actually held, that some suspensions are permitted by the Constitution under the statute that Congress passed. So that's why I say it's an uphill battle. There's some precedent in this very circuit against the constitutional argument that Judge Newman is making.
Apparently, this proceeding has led to calls to change the statutory framework for evaluating judges for potential disability and misconduct. Is there any agreement on what changes should be made, and do you think changes should be made?
I do think this episode has revealed some flaws in the system that nobody has seen before. I mean, some of them would be pretty easy to correct. You wouldn't even need the statute, for example, to put into the rules that if you have a complaint against a circuit judge and the chief judge is not going to dismiss it, that ought to go to the chief justice to decide whether to transfer. That would be a simple change in the rule. Under the statute, and maybe some of this could be done by rule also, I do think that when you have an intrusive order like this one, requiring a judge to undergo a neuropsychological examination, to provide intimate medical details, there ought to be a little bit more process. For example, that the committee should hold some sort of hearing at which the witnesses could be cross-examined by the judge. And assuming that the committee goes ahead with the request or order, I would like to see immediate review available of that. I would also like to see that in situations like this, where you have a proceeding that can result in an Article III judge being told she can't hear cases anymore for a substantial period of time, I would like to see the review by the National Committee as an independent review, not simply abuse of discretion, as was done here. I don't think those are major changes. Still preserves the same framework, but I think you could build in some protections that would not greatly extend the process, but would assure everybody that a federal judge who's been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate is not being effectively ousted from office by a process that people can legitimately question.
Now, this has also focused the debate on, you know, the aging judiciary we have and judges who have lifetime appointments. And Francis Shen, who's on the faculty at Harvard Medical School's Center for Law, wrote a law review article in 2020 that found that 75% of judges die while still serving. And the average age of judges in federal judges in 2017 was 69. I mean, do you see this as a concern?
Well, it's certainly something that people should be and are looking at. One thing I wonder about those figures, I suspect that those figures include senior judges. And it's important to emphasize that a senior judge is a judge who may well be sitting and hearing cases, but under the statute, a senior judge can hear cases only to the extent authorized by the chief judge or the circuit council. And indeed, one of the things we haven't mentioned in our discussion of the very lengthy proceedings here is that at the very start, Chief Judge Moore was urging Judge Newman to take senior status, and Judge Newman refused, and I'm sure that a very large part of her refusal, reason for the refusal, was that her ability to hear cases would then be entirely dependent on whether the chief judge allowed it. And that suggests to me that another line of possible reform here, and it addresses exactly the problem you focused on, and it's something we need to be looking at. One possibility would be, again, procedural. And I'm a proceduralist, and I do look for procedural solutions. But if a judge who is in a position to take senior status could be assured that her ability in the future to hear cases was not dependent on a single individual or perhaps even on the members of that circuit's council, the judge might be willing to go ahead, confident that it will be a different group, perhaps with some channels of review, so that the judge's ability to hear cases would not be controlled by a single individual or a small group of her colleagues.
So I found this somewhat concerning. Eliza Schatzman, founder of the Legal Accountability Project, said, "We hear from a lot of clerks working for judges who are too old to serve. In most instances, law clerks and other judicial employees stay silent due to potential reputational harms that could result from blowing the whistle." And that rings true because the legal profession sometimes seems very small and things get around quickly. What can be done?
Well, I think, first of all, the Judicial Conference has adopted some procedures that are designed to deal with that situation. This was done in the wake of the allegations of sexual harassment, which is a different kind of problem, but calls for a similar solution because, again, the concern was, and there's certainly some reason to recognize that concern, the concern was that, you know, law clerks and other court employees who were in the best position to identify either misconduct or disability on the part of the judge were not reporting it because of the fear of retaliation. As I said, the Judicial Conference has taken some steps. They can probably do more. I mean, my own thought has been to establish a kind of portal through which any employee with a concern about a judge, whether it's misconduct or disability, could communicate that to the chief judge, and the chief judge would then investigate it while at the same time protecting the employee from retaliation. I mean, there are limits to that, obviously, because, as you say, it's a small profession, and in a small courthouse, for example, or a court with only a handful of judges, it's very difficult to do that. But I think there's probably more, even more, that the judiciary could do. But I want to emphasize the judiciary is at this point quite sensitive to that. And they are trying through EDR procedures, anonymous reporting, reporting to judiciary officials outside the circuit. They're trying a number of things to do that. But there's more. As you say, the fear of employees is very, very real.
And Arthur, at one point, Judge Newman's attorney said they would appeal to the Supreme Court if necessary. Is this a case that the Supreme Court would want to take?
If the district court ruling is affirmed by the Court of Appeals, as I expect it would be, that can be taken to the Supreme Court, discretionary review. I would doubt very much that the court would want to get involved in this. The system is in place. The way to deal with it, I think, is through the Judicial Conference and through Congress. I mean, we haven't talked much about Congress here. This system was basically established in 1980. There were some tweaks in, what was it, 1990 and 2002 in a statute I helped to write. But even that's now more than 20 years. And this is something that Congress might want to take another look at. Unfortunately, given the polarization and gridlock in Washington, I don't hold out much hope for that. But I would not expect the Supreme Court to get involved.
Arthur, before I let you go, will you sort of recap where Judge Newman can appeal?
Just to recapitulate, again, we have the two tracks here, and it really, as you mentioned at the outset, there's just so much going on. It's sometimes hard to disentangle these. But the order of the Judicial Conference Committee can be reviewed by the Judicial Conference. So we may yet see that. I don't expect it, but we might see it. Turning now to the district court proceeding. The district court proceeding is still going on because, as you mentioned, not all of the claims were dismissed. Not all of the counts in the complaint were dismissed. So there will be further briefing and perhaps argument on the rest of the case. Judge Cooper will then enter a final judgment, which I expect will probably throw out the whole case. And then at that point, with a final judgment against her, Judge Newman could appeal to the D.C. Court of Appeals. And given the precedent in the D.C. Court of Appeals, I would expect that to be affirmed. So at this point, if somebody asked me, you know, what is the channel most likely to give Judge Newman some kind of relief, it would probably be the full Judicial Conference. But I think the odds are against that also.
Well, Judge Newman certainly took every legal path open to challenge this suspension. You have to say that. Thanks so much, Arthur, for helping untangle all this. That's Professor Arthur Hellman of the University of Pittsburgh Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.